John needs the better part of an hour to coax Ben out of his hiding place under the bed, where he rolled himself up in a blanket like a quilted tortoise. John waited 10 interminable minutes on the porch after calling Taylor. He made himself wait and listen and scan the property for more intruders before going to Ben and drawing the boy out with the doll soldiers that John keeps in a special box. Taylor announces herself on the comm and comes in at a half run, disheveled and holding her sidearm naked in her hand. She crouches by the settee where Ben is fondled in his father's coat, staring sightlessly at the dark hearth. John sits on the armrest, 9mm in reach on the coffee table, but out of the boy's sight. "I inspected the perimeter for half a mile through the woods and did not find signs of a presence," Taylor says, eyes trained on Ben's pale, blank face. "I borrowed motion sensors from my office and set them up around the yard." She fixes narrowed eyes at John. "You are both unharmed?" "He walked away when I enforced my property rights." "John." She stands and leans over him. Her fingers knot in the hair at the nape of his neck, sweet pressure guiding his forehead to hers. "We may have to run," John says, breathing her breath. "But if you want to stay..." "I would not have it," she cuts him off, though not as sharply as she could. "We have a good life here." "Yes, and we will fight for our right to it." The motion alarm is more of a soft ring than a whine, but it gets John up and aiming at the door. Taylor brushes a hand over his forearm. "I called a Katerin," she says, and a brief glance through the curtains reveals the diminutive case officer walking quickly up to the porch. "I have to talk to a Katerin for a minute," John says, crouching in front of Ben. "I'm going to step outside, but no one is going to take me away, and no one is going to take you away. I won't allow it. Taylor won't allow it. Okay?" Ben doesn't even blink. "If you hear some yelling in a single shot," John says, throwing Taylor a look, "don't come running too fast." He stalks out the door, intercepts a Katerin before she can knock, and drags her by the arm into the backyard, where the wind is holding back the rain. "Honored guest Shepherd," she squeaks. "Associated guest Imogen told me you were attacked." John shoves her toward a garden chair. "Sit down," he bites out. Ekaterin sits. "What can you tell me about Acastus Kolya?" She lights up, smiling. "You've met honored guest Kolya? Excellent. I knew you would get along famously. He's interesting, too. Not as much as you, of course. But," she leers at him, "memory contributions from our local guests can become so tedious after a while. Harvest, harvest, culling, harvest, trading, harvest, harvest. But you and honored guest Kolya, I advise that your house be built close to his own. I'm his case officer, too, you see." "What? No, I don't see. Me and the little fascist that could are not going to get along famously, or any other way mortal enemies can get along. He's tried to kill me and some very good friends of mine too many times. Pretty much killed my dog and pissed on my Bible, too. And are you crazy?"
"I don't think so," Ekaterin says, but she seems willing to discuss it.
John resists the urge to pace, to pull out all of his hair. "How did he find out about me? When did he get here?"
"Honored guest Kolya was with us for a full season before you came to Bajan. As for finding out about your presence, he often has business in the cities. Perhaps he spotted you or guest Imogen at the rail station."
She sobers. "It's not our policy to advertise the identity of our guests to each other."
"Look, Ekaterin, this isn't going to end well."
"Why not? You have so much in common."
"Exactly! We have so much violence in common. He's got to be armed. I'm definitely armed."
"Oh, pish," Ekaterin says, waving her hand.
"Pish?
What kind of hosts would we be if we let our guests come to harm? We take our responsibility towards your safety very seriously. And these weapons are such a hazard. The contraptions some guests come up with..." She shakes her head. "All weapons are detected and neutralized by maintenance drones upon arrival or soon after."
John stares down at his 9mm, betrayed. He hefts the sidearm and considers testing Ekaterin's confidence in Bajarian technology by shooting her in the leg, but he aims into the woods before squeezing the trigger. Nothing happens. He tries again. Nothing. He ejects the clip, shakes it, inspects the bullets. All accounted for. "Why can they neuter his gun," he wonders, "but can't fix the leaks in the bathroom?"
"We know how attached some of our guests are to their weaponry,"
Ekaterin says, fondly. This seems a more humane solution than confiscating them altogether. Most never even notice. She rises from the chair, slowly, as if John might turn around and bite her.
There, there, she says, patting his shoulder. We have much experience in these matters. Do you need to talk to a counselor?
No, John says, lost.
We strive to adapt to the special needs of our favored guests in all ways, she continues, as if he hadn't spoken. Our friends' basic requirements tend to be simple and specific. They can't eat, they can't have sex, and they can't die. They can't fuck each other.
Absurdly, the word shocks him coming from her.
And they can't kill each other, cannot fathom it, in fact, which seems to have stunted their capacity for creative problem-solving considerably. These particular requirements make for a very skewed guest population. Therefore, our main concerns have been security and the prevention of sexually propagated diseases.
So you're telling me, John asks, for the sake of clarity, that Bajan's favored guests are either old whores or old soldiers? He rubs his hands over his eyes. It gives a whole new meaning to make love not war.
Oh, no, 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 Ekaterin exclaims. She winds her arms around John's waist and hugs him warmly. There's no rule that says you can't do both.
John contemplates seeking Kolya out. Maybe a good old pounding followed by a pissing contest would result in a status quo that'd let him relax a little, though there's no guessing whether Ekaterin would intervene. He wonders at other security provisions, the kind of surveillance which guarantees the safety of the guests, and who does the policing, whether they are all as polite and amenable as Ekaterin. He doesn't want to test it. John has more pressing worries, because now it's Ben who can't make it through the night. The boy sleeps fitfully and wakes up wailing and panic-stricken, as frightened by his own shapeless screams as he is by the horrors in his head. Crying and choking on his own incomprehension, howling at the ceiling and the universe that couldn't even grant words for his terror, for his supplications and his brutal beginnings. There's nothing John can do but hang on to the thin body and grit his teeth against the impotence that could so easily be the end of him. But he can't let go. He's all Ben's got, no matter that it kills John to see Ben in so much pain. Nothing has ever brought him closer to breaking than this child's suffering. So they rock together, huddled in the middle of the bed, too far from daybreak for hope of a release, and John makes what few promises he can keep.
I know, Betty, he whispers over Ben's frustrated growls. You've got so much to say. But I hear you, Ben, and tomorrow we'll walk to the top of the hill. I'll carry you on my shoulders.
He stops, jaw locked, throat tight and raw, and Ben pants, eyes wide.
And you can shout to the sky and to the whole world. You can tell them. You can let go of that barbaric yawp.
John tries to laugh, but his lungs are filled with broken glass.
And everyone will know. We'll all be listening.
Taylor stands in the doorframe, her eyes hard and shining, a hand over her mouth like a shroud pulled over a stillborn scream. John stares at her, and he knows his whole face is begging. They are enraged and undone, and it doesn't seem right that the universe could hold all of it.
I love you, Ben. You're not alone. I love you so much. Breathe, Ben. Please, breathe with me.
Fuck you, bitch, John will think right then. Fuck you. It isn't the grievance of a man toward a nameless deity. Early on Tuesday morning, a hand grips his shoulder and shakes abruptly.
John says, "Damn it, Rodney, I have last watch," and wakes up and jerks to his feet.
The living room is desaturated by dawn, polished furnishings scattered like fish bones washed out on a beach. He fell asleep on the sofa, still dressed, the dregs of a cup of tea on the floor by his feet, an afghan tangled in his legs. He looks for Ben in his sidearm and finds neither. His body and brain feel like he's been tied down and beaten.
John, are you awake?
Taylor's fingers dig between bone and muscle, jolting him.
I have looked everywhere. I cannot find Ben.
What? John processes the state of the living room with one look, trusting Taylor to have checked the integrity of all access points, then strides into the bedroom. His raincoat's missing, and his boots. He could have gone out to the treehouse, he says, already moving.
I have searched it. He is not there, nor is he in the backyard, nor the field.
Taylor meets his frown head-on when he pins her with a look,
angry that she let him sleep through it. I found this on the kitchen table. The strokes of the crayon on the sheet are angry and deep as a stab wound. Ben tried to spell what might have been John's name, but gave up, thwarted and desperate, the letters breaking off on a cliffside, a mountain, a hill. John swears, and briefly squeezes his eyes shut. He's gone up there. I told him, and he's gone by himself. It is raining heavily, and there is little light. He'll try to follow the stream. Damn it! How long since he's been gone? Taylor's eyebrows fold. I could not say. I am sorry. The storm has washed the ground clean. John is already moving, tying on his boots, pulling on gloves and his warmest raincoat. He packs a knapsack, water, first aid kit, flashlight, a small box of biscuits, a handful of magnesium flares, cursing the loss of his tack vest. He pins his Bajan issue communicator to his collar and sheaths his combat knife in his right boot. He can't see how the technicians could possibly have neutralized that. Taylor follows suit. Calm a catter in, he says. If she doesn't already know what's going on, explain. I'll follow the stream as far as I can. It's my best hope of tracking him. As soon as you're done, let me know what's Ekaterin's advice. She has resources we don't. Then take the path cutting north through the woods. It's better to cover that one, too, and watch for landslides. We will find him, Taylor says. But John's already out the door, down the porch steps, across the front yard and through the gate. On a clear day, dawn is pristine and liquid blue, the landscape gunmetal gray, as if Bajan were hoarding color and energy, powering low. Today the cloud cover sucks the light out of the ground and leaves only shadows. The rain falls in sheets, thicker and sharper as John pushes deeper into the woods. The meandering brook is already a torrent that surges over rocks and dug-out roots. Ben! He shouts. Ben! John's eyes shift from the ground to the top of the hill he can only guess at through the liquid curtains drawn between the trees. He trips one, two, three times and picks himself up, blinded by sweat and rain, grappling at trunks, at helpless saplings and slippery roots. He shouts for Ben again, but his voice is hoarse and the rain bruises the words and pounds them into the ground. Shepherd! Raindrops shred tree bark into paper paste, peppering John with shrapnel. Shepherd! A heavy hand grips John's raincoat between his shoulder blades, and he twists around, arm raised, teeth bared, prepared to swing. Colonel, wait! Kolya lets go and raises his hands. He gestures to the comm unit strapped to his wrist and yells over the tumult. Ekaterin called me! John's rage rolls out blood red behind his eyes. I don't have time for you, Kolya! She sent me to help! Kolya isn't wearing a cap, and the rain pours in rivers down his beard. My word of honor is a soldier and a Jnai. I am here to help you find your son. It may be one of the toughest threat assessments he's ever made, but after a moment in which he considers snapping the man's neck, John sets his jaw and points to the top. He's heading up there. He's wearing a yellow raincoat. I don't know what kind of lead he's got, and he can't call for help. His name is Ben. He doesn't wait for an acknowledgement, turning around and grabbing a low branch to pull himself forward. They don't talk. There isn't breath to spare, and once it looks like Kolya is going to keep to John's left wing, John can't be bothered to think about him. What's a leisurely trek in fair weather requires a single-minded focus close to abnegation. The grove is thinning, taking away handholds and footholds. John shouldn't stay in the torrent's bed, but he refuses to stray from Ben's most likely path. Fighting the weight of too many sleepless nights, John can't react to Kolya's warning in time. Look out! His eyes shoot up from the ground, and he sees the wall of debris surging ahead of sound. A flash, an instant photograph of mud and hillside boiling where a stream should be. The flow takes him out above the knees, and he spins three quarters of a turn before going down. There isn't time to yell before the hill fills his mouth and eyes and ears. There is pain, sharp, in too many parts of his body, and disorientation like a short, brutal ride in a centrifuge. It can't be more than seconds before his arm is yanked, reclaiming him from the earth and dislocating his shoulder in a single move. He whites out and comes back to a pressing need for oxygen, water pouring on his face, strong arms wrapped around his ribcage, squeezing until he heaves. He vomits, coughs, vomits again.
consciousness weaving around the knife shoved in his shoulder. Something inside says, "Let go," and something else snarls, "Don't you fucking dare." "Drink," someone says, pressing a water bottle to his lips. A little water floods his mouth, cool and clean. He throws up again, huddled on his knees, tears flowing with the pain. A calloused hand cups his forehead and keeps him from regurgitating forest debris into his own lap. When he's done, tilting sideways with a breath like a sob, another hand braces him by his belt. Kolya is talking.
"Are you from the promontory? Colonel Shepherd requires immediate medical assistance. Can you triangulate my signal?"
"No." John lets himself push forward, catching his weight on his good arm, jarred into a bitten scream.
"Have you located the boy? Hold, Tayla Amagan." "Shepherd, keep still."
Clenching his eyes shut against the wire-tight constriction of his sternum and the burn that spreads down his collarbone, John gathers his body and heaves himself upright, functional arm flailing for a hold, legs shaky as a newborn colt's. The rain washed the mud from his face, but his hair is falling in his eyes, and he blinks harshly, searching for a direction. Kolya's shoulder materializes under his hand, and John lets the Janai shore him up.
"You're injured, Shepherd. A Katerin dispatched airborne reconnaissance crafts. They will locate the child."
"Kolya," John rasps. The agony of a scarred throat is exquisite. "Fuck off or help me." He doesn't have the strength to hold his head up, but he could swear that Kolya smiles when he says, "Very well."
John staggers the rest of the way in a state short of full awareness, each step autonomic and relying on another for direction. Exhaustion, pain, the war drums of cold and rain seem muffled and distant, a story whispered in a stranger's voice against his ear. They reach the hilltop, buffeted by lateral winds. John doesn't spare a glance for the cities in the plain or the aircraft darting toward them like a cadre of silver fruit flies. He tries to call for Ben, but can only dredge up a croak. Gripping the sleeve of Kolya's long coat, John asks in a voice all but gone, "Call his name," and Kolya stares at him.
"Ben," John says, "call for him."
When at last the storm weakens, John's strength goes with it. Coughing harshly, he slides down a tree trunk, shoulder held tight to his torso by Kolya's hasty bindings. Kolya is stalking the breadth of the promontory, keeping to the edge of the copse. He searches the ground for tracks, shouting Ben's name over the wind. John's vision is graying, but as he tips his head back, color flickers through the foliage.
"Hey," he murmurs, "funny little monkey."
He lifts his arm and crooks a finger.
"Come down," he mouths. "Come here."
Cautiously, shooting nervous looks at the daunting bulk of the Janai, Ben wriggles down the tree and crawls to his father. He's shivering but unhurt, washed clean by the rain.
"Did you tell them?" John whispers, rubbing their noses together. "Did they listen?"
Ben nods and coils on top of him.
"Yeah," John says, before he goes away. "Me too."
John comes to briefly as he's loaded on a gurney, a Katerin hovering over him.
"Oh, dear," she says, sounding genuinely upset. "That wasn't supposed to happen."
He drifts up close to the surface some indeterminate amount of time later, to a chest on fire and a familiar sensation of warmth along his spine. Before the bed is jostled and the feeling disappears, Taylor says softly,
"No, Ben. Your father is very ill and needs all of his strength to recover. You must not disturb him."
Small fingers, clumsy and warm, pat his brow and cheek.
"Come, we will collect plants from the herb garden and make a tea that will ease our sore throats."
John tries to open his eyes, to let Taylor know that it's okay, he doesn't mind, he wants Ben to stay, but the world slips through his fingers like a goldfish and swims away. When he wakes up again, he's not really awake. He's back in the cell aboard the Hive ship, and the bitch is coming for him. He was so cold before, but he's burning up now and comes out fighting. The inhuman hands of the drones close around arm and hip to hold him down. It hurts to buck up and twist and resist. The right side of his body feels wrong. But what's a little more pain in this hell?
What can they possibly do to him now? Voices demand that he give up, but no way. It's the last thing he's got, making it as hard for them as possible, not letting them strap him to the table again without sharing some of his rage. But he hears sobbing, and he remembers Ben, remembers that as long as the bastards are busy with him, they'll leave Ben alone. So he stops fighting, forces himself to go limp, and lets them take him away. For a while after that, reality is a fuzzy patchwork of memories darting past, some indistinct, some much too vivid. He's led back to the world by a beam of light aimed at his right eyelid, a muffled, arrhythmic pounding that originates outside his head, and the mother of all needs to pee. He opens his eyes and flinches away from the play of sunlight across his face, setting off a chain reaction of dull aches everywhere. Swallowing back a groan, he takes stock of his surroundings. His bedroom, his bed, curtains billowing lazily across the open window. The breeze is warm, the mattress comfortable, and despite residual pains and the urging of his bladder, John takes a moment to appreciate that he's millions of light years away from the hive ship. He's about to investigate his state of dress under the covers when the discomfort in his bladder swells and fades away. Unsettled, John ventures a hand toward the waistband of his drawstring pants and encounters a solid obstruction, the rough shape of a scarab, glued to his skin right above his groin. Having experienced the wonders of Bajarian medicine before, John orders himself sternly not to freak out. However that gizmo works, it beats a catheter Foley by virtue of not being shoved in his dick. He manages to sit up and haul his legs over the side of the bed on the second try. Movement reveals another scarab at his throat, and one on his ribs, below his bandaged armpit. He doesn't try to rip them off, aware that he should be hurting a lot more than he is, weary enough of pain that he'll put up with the mid-level freakout of alien medtech. The bedroom door is wide open on the hallway in the living room, and there's no one in sight. John debates calling out, but drags himself to his feet and shuffles to the bathroom instead. He doesn't look that bad for a guy who got caught in a mudslide. Pale skin brings out the scruff of a week-old beard, his hair dried sideways, and a bruise is already turning purple charcoal black on his cheekbone, but he's better rested than he's felt in a while. He splashes water on his face and chest and brushes his teeth. Spreading toothpaste one-handed requires every bit of ingenuity he can dredge up from survival school. He foregoes shaving entirely. A slow tour of the house reveals a string of empty rooms and a handwritten note in the kitchen. John is drawn outside by the lure of the suns and the forceful hammering echoing through the walls. The front door hangs open on a sun-washed porch. The boards are almost too hot under his bare feet, not enough to scald, but enough for the heat to spread up his calves, unlock his knees, and nestle at the base of his spine. It's the most beautiful day he's seen on Bajan, the grass so green it sparkles, field and ocean and sky preternaturally blue, colors more primordial than primary. John digs his toes into the lawn and lets the earth remind him that he's safe, that everyone is safe. "Good afternoon, Shepherd." John turns and lifts his head slowly, bringing a hand up to support his shoulder. "What the hell are you doing up there?" Kolya sits on the roof like a Viking with a passion for DIY, a hammer in one hand and a shingle in the other. It's a mystery to John how the support beams can possibly hold the weight. "The storm blew off most of the roof cover above your largest room," Kolya says, adjusting the angle of a nail before giving it a firm whack. It goes straight through. "A Caterin's technicians couldn't handle the repairs?" Kolya stares down at him until John's forced to concede. "Yeah, right. Forget I said anything." It's nice to know the Bajarians aren't any more skilled at Janai home design than they are at building captain houses. Though how hard can it be to dig an underground bunker? "Thanks," John says, after clearing his throat. "Not for the repairs, though obviously for that too. But for helping out during the storm. I owe you one. A big one." Kolya nods. "Ekaterin said that you would wake up today. Tayla Amagan took your son to the cities to buy food and other supplies. She seemed to believe that the child's presence would overwhelm you upon waking. She left a note on the kitchen table, assuring you that he is in good health and none the worse for his ordeal." Which doesn't mean all that much. But it says a lot about what's been going on while he was out, that Tayla would leave him alone with the Janai.
How long was I out?
Another shingle. Another whack.
4 days. Your condition was serious, though not so that you couldn't be treated here, with the medical technician monitoring your progress remotely.
The air still carries the clean scent of violent summer rains, and John sits on the stoop's highest step, contemplating the horizon while Kolya works through the rest of the pile of shingles. Whack, whack, whack. The ladder propped against the house creaks ominously under the Janiah's weight, but it holds. Kolya walks past John inside the house without comment, and returns with a glass of juice and a bottle of something brown. They sit side by side, the step wide enough that John doesn't have to fold around the railing or lose another shoulder.
You know that Cowan isn't in charge anymore, right?
John asks, looking straight ahead.
You've heard about Layden's hostile takeover?
And about your, shall we say, unwitting sponsorship of the new regime? There's no way to tell whether Kolya's pissed or amused.
Why didn't you go back? Layden's a smart guy, but he didn't strike me as being cut out for planetary leadership.
The months I have spent in exile have altered my perspective, Kolya says, and my strategy, accordingly.
Yeah, John agrees. It can do that.
After a moment of silence, Kolya says, "A son," and John cuts him a look. The man is shaking his head. The beard and the hair remind John of his father's old black spaniel.
"I have to say, the resemblance between you is striking. I wasn't aware that you were a father, Colonel."
"That it'd have changed anything?"
"No."
"Thought so," John says. "And quit calling me Colonel. I've resigned my commission."
Kolya frowns, saying,
"I suspected, but I didn't want to make assumptions," which is almost comical. "You don't have to tell me, Shepard."
John sets down his glass, tensing.
"I don't."
"No," the Janai says, "though I'd imagine it has something to do with this."
Before John can flinch away, Kolya grabs the bottom of his t-shirt and lifts the material all the way up, exposing the white feeding mark John knows lies between his shoulder blades. It's faded like an old scar, the size of a melted dime, almost invisible. Notwithstanding the lack of claw marks, no one in this galaxy would doubt its origin. John jumps off the porch, moving too fast for the scarabs to keep up. The burst of pain wrenches a cry, and he hunches over, clutching his shoulder. Kolya is there to hold him up.
"Let go of me!"
John tries to protect his vulnerable side, but Kolya only tows him to a garden chair. The Janai steps back, arms crossed. He leans against the railing while John recovers his breath, not looking away when John wipes involuntary tears from his face.
"If you touch him, you die slow," John rasps.
"I gave my word," Kolya says. "If I wanted to harm your son, I would have done it when I saw him feed on you."
"He doesn't feed on anyone else," John says, head hanging heavy, adrenaline fading out of his system. "And he takes almost nothing.
Hours, maybe days of his life. John would never have found a better use for that time."
"Imogen stopped him from draining you."
John bangs his fist on the armrest.
"He's not Wraith. Not any more than Taylor or me."
John looks up.
"Not much more than either of us."
Silence settles in the interstice between the words they both lack, and John looks west to the border of the woods. The storm has wreaked surprisingly little devastation, save for a few snapped branches. If the mudslide reached the bottom of the hill, it didn't come near the house.
"It's a long story," John says. "You're not going to like any of it."
He doesn't know why it should matter that Kolya understands. Maybe for the same reason that Taylor's acceptance counted above all others. This place is all that Ben's got to call home, and your home shouldn't hate you.
"All the stories my mother ever told me were of the Wraith," Kolya answers dryly. "I never liked those much either, but I learned to live with them."
John shrugs and bites his lip at the burn.
"Fine. Try not to interrupt."
"There's no good way to start, but it begins with Taylor, the gift and the Wraith experiments. Beckett and the idea of the retrovirus used as a biological weapon. Elia and his own conversion." He speaks to the floor or the sky, but he's aware of Kolya moving from curious to startled to appalled. Midway through, Kolya drags up a chair.
He sits elbows on knees and hands clasped, gaze unwavering. When John explains Michael and the deal with the Wraith, Kolya squeezes his fists so tight he must be drawing blood. The muscles of neck and jaw bunch and twist, the grimace of a predator chewing on prey.
Shepherd, you...
Kolya's wordless with apoplexy.
I know, John says, shoulders hunched and eyes tired. Don't bother. I got smacked down in ways you'd never have thought of.
Some of the decisions John made in the past year, Kolya can appreciate uniquely for being an exile and a soldier. Others, less, and for the same reasons. Different histories, different cultures, different militaries. The span of a galaxy between them. There's nothing to gain by sharing some of the realizations John's come to, the questions he's asked himself, given distance and a whole new perspective. Case in point, if John tried to explain the Atlanteans' failures in terms of a lack of doctrine or inexperience in asymmetric warfare, Kolya might very well stare blankly at the stupid Earthling before slugging him in the jaw. In Pegasus, no humans ever hoped to experience the symmetric kind. How could they fail to understand that? Strategic considerations hadn't entered John's mind when he'd hitched a ride through the Hive ship's hyperspace window. He'd been all tactics and objectives. Sneak in, free Ronan and Rodney, give the Wraith the runaround while Rodney used his brand spankin' new expertise in Wraith software to develop a virus of his own. If all else failed, break out a canister of retrovirus so that any Wraith who reached the Milky Way did so human. Run like hell. All else hadn't failed, except for that last part, and John'd yelled at them to go, had watched his teammates take off in a dart from his choice spot on the floor under a Wraith pile. He hadn't doubted for a second that they would come back for him, that they'd try. "You ever been interrogated by a Wraith queen?" he asked Kolya, who shakes his head no, but looks grimly intrigued. John rubs his hand over his face. Turns out that repeated exposure doesn't help. He wasn't used to thinking of the Wraith as individuals, as personalities, but she had been smarter, less dogmatic, more patient than the others, willing to treat him as something other than cattle, to not underestimate the human on his knees. Exposure to Michael had changed that hive. She had been angry at the loss of Earth and the hyperdrive. Of course she'd been pissed, and let the drones bat him around. But she'd asked straightforward questions, too, about command codes and gate addresses and the location of Earth, about troop numbers, the ZPM, the Daedalus, their allies, the ATA, the city's defenses. He'd almost leaned into the drone's fists then, because he was the military leader of Atlantis, and he'd allowed the enemy access to his base. No one else was to blame. John sees that reflected in Kolya's pockmarked face. They kept it up for a couple of days. She held the threat of feeding back. At first I couldn't understand why. She seemed, I don't know, intrigued, bothered by something. He hadn't noticed it at first, the lack of sustained pressure on his mind. Michael had drifted in at one point, when John had been struggling to keep himself sharp. "Remember," John had said, smirking blood red, "people are friends, not food." When she brought in her pet geek, "I knew my holiday was about to go downhill," John says, and he remembers the smile that gave Send in the Clowns a whole new ring, stretching impossibly wide when the Wraith scientist had stripped John naked and strapped him in the scanner. John had named him Dick, because Mengele was too easy. The queen he called Mary Jane, until she became just Bitch. She had leaned over the table, her shark's smile close to his mouth, her tongue surprisingly dainty and pink, slipping out, a horrific prelude to a kiss. "Your smell is enticing," she'd purred, inhaling his fear. "A hive smell, a nest smell. Perhaps..." She had licked a strip of skin from his jaw to his ear, mocking him. "You are family." "She couldn't get into my mind, and she wanted to know why," John says. "Dick's scans showed primordial Wraith genetic material embedded in mine. He thought that my ancestors had been subjected to illegal hybridization experiments, but somehow the trait that gives people like Taylor their gift was bred out of my lineage, closing my mind off to the hive." He coughs, mouth dry. The bitch wasn't much for that kind of speculation, so she jumped straight to human testing. John coughs again and lifts his glass, but it's empty. Kolya eyes him, takes the glass inside the house, and returns with two bottles of the brown stuff. "Root beer with a kick," John comments after a swallow, nodding in appreciation. "Think the doctor would approve?" "Go on, Shepherd," Kolya says, without compassion or empathy or much of anything else. But he waits patiently for John to drain 3/4 of the bottle. "She fed on me." He hadn't known that his throat could produce such a sound, or that his lungs could sustain it that long. "But she gave it all back." Taylor and Ben returned from the cities loaded with shopping bags and trailed by a Katarin. Ben's enthusiasm is visible from the gate as he bounces up the lawn, chin up, free of the tension that had strung out the small body before the storm. It will come again. Nothing is ever that easy. But John's gotten pretty deliberate about enjoying the good times in between. Kolya's mouth is still stretched in a grim line, prompting John to kick him in the shin. "I don't want you to look like that in front of him." He heaves himself out of the deck chair with a grunt. His ass is numb. He feels wrung out like an old towel, and now his toes are bruised. "Cheer up. We'll finish this later." Ben has clearly been wondering why his father's been lounging in bed all week. Impervious to Taylor's imprecations of caution and calm, he tows John to the couch, sits him down, and proceeds to unpack their shopping one item at a time. "Paint, paint, paint, and oh, more paint," John laughs. "We're running out of things to paint, you know. You'll have to get started on trees." When the bags are empty and Kolya has, out of some karmic notion, been relegated to the kitchen to cook dinner under Taylor's supervision, Ben brings out his notebook, leaving John to scour his memory for inferences and entailments and partial derivative symbols, which he is then required to draw, left-handed, but not, thank God, explain. Before he's forced to admit to the voice in his head, which sounds a lot like Rodney, that he never cared one whit about tensor products, Ekaterin plops herself down on the couch, flashing her inoffensive Mogwai smile, and appropriates his good arm. "Hi," he says.
"Hi, honored guest shepherd."
"Thanks for the bugs." He nudges the scarab glued to his carotid. "Much less conspicuous than the last one that bit me in the neck." Ekaterin points at his groin.
"You can take that one off."
Thanks.
"But the others must stay on for 2 more days. If you require assistance..."
"Well, no." Like a true Bajarian resident, he hardly blushes anymore.
"Okay."
"Ekaterin, call me John, all right?"
"All right, John."
That never worked before. John bends to ruffle his son's hair, and Ben looks up from the floor. "You keep working on those derivatives," John says gravely, hauling himself to his feet, "because you'll have to explain it all to your old dad someday." Ben's eyes smile, if not his mouth, and that's enough. Ekaterin badgers him into a coat before they step outside to watch the tail end of sunset. When she lights an unfiltered cigarette, John raises an eyebrow.
"I didn't know you guys had cigarettes. I didn't know you smoked."
She shrugs helplessly.
"I didn't yesterday. I went out to a parlor for a drink, downloaded a smoker's leech, got addicted. Spent the day running around like a wraith with both hands cut off, hunting for a pack."
John rolls his eyes, and it all comes out, a Bajarian logorrhea.
"I'm so sorry, honored... John, protected guest shepherd should never have been put in jeopardy without our knowing. Such a breach of contractual safety will never occur again. If I have to guard this house myself, you have my word. And I'm so very ashamed that you were injured because of my decision to send honored guest Kolya to you. Why, if you had not been distracted by his unwanted presence..."
"Ekaterin, shut up." She plasters herself to his side, radiating heat, alive on the memories of others.
"Please, you're not angry. You won't leave us."
He couldn't leave if he wanted to. His skin is clammy, every cell clamoring for rest, and the cigarette smoke is making him nauseous. "Stop fretting. I'll report for tax duty tomorrow as scheduled."
"Absolutely not," Ekaterin says. "You're exempt from sessions until your body can handle the stress of extraction, which I have in good authority won't be for another 20 days.
"Oh." He blinks, allowing himself to take that in. It sounds like a paid vacation. Something for nothing, time for himself, safety with no strings attached. He's not quite sure what to do with that.
"Thanks."
Dinner is a surreal experience. Taylor and Kolya make ruthless small talk about the care of herb gardens,
Ben builds tensor products with his peas, and Ekaterin instructs John on the wonders of Bajarian catheters. She once traded leeches with a medical technician while fondling his knee. He dozes off mid-sentence and leans on the women all the way to bed. John sleeps 16 hours, which doesn't seem to shock anyone, and he gathers from Taylor that the infection in his lungs got pretty bad before it got better. Breakfast is a cup of black tea in the backyard. Another sunny day, still atypical, but cooler than the last. Taylor says he isn't confined to the house, so they put together an overly ambitious picnic, lure Ben away from his kaleidoscopic trees with the siren song of multicolored seashells, and pile up in the minnow. The shore is an hour's rambling walk from the house, a third of that in the transport. John is happy to let Taylor drive. He is aware, not for the first time, that he should miss flying more, that he hasn't tried to sweeten a Catarin into making him a ship yet, but he doesn't know where that thought could take him, and he lets it wither in the sun. Ben is humming under his breath between a purr and a song, his back against John's side and his feet up on the back seat. John dozes, rocked gently by the ride in Taylor's sure hand, head resting on the folded soft top. The littoral is a wild and deserted stretch of dune, thick gray sand tamed into a narrow beach along the waterline, dotted here and there with outbursts of chaparral. Blackened lengths of driftwood are strewn across the shore, stuck deep into the sediment at the water's edge and reaching out to the sky like severed arms, the unwitting perches of a colony of weary seabirds. The ocean, buoyant and green, never fails to remind John of the Dead Sea, though he's caught some sweet breaks the days before a storm. Here the breeze is cooler and the light hazier, but they spread their blanket in the sweet spot of a dune and the sweaters come off. "I hope you are feeling better," Taylor says after lunch, when Ben is engaged in a solemn staring contest with the local wildlife, and John is letting the sand's magic work the kinks out of his shoulder. He doesn't open his eyes, but smiles. "You're not going to pull an Ekaterin on me, are you? I'm doing fine. In fact, I'm doing great. Ben and I are sleeping better, and generally aren't as much of a sour bunch to be around. If a mud bath and a bad shoulder is what it takes, I can live with it." "I do not know what pulling an Ekaterin means, but I will choose not to be insulted." John sneaks her a look under his lashes. Taylor's smile is indulgent but distracted. "You've taken a lot of time off work lately. It's been a problem?" "Ekaterin has, I believe you would say, pulled some strings. As a result, my employer has been quite understanding." John sits up too fast, groaning. "Tell me they haven't asked you to..." He points at his temple. "No." Taylor sounds honestly taken aback. "I would not do such a thing without talking to you about it first." "Yeah, sorry." John waves his hand in a don't-mind-the-crazy-earthling gesture, and he keeps still when she tugs at a lock of his hair, submitting to her no-nonsense tenderness. There's nothing sharp about Taylor. He knows that. Despite her skill and her fierce love, nothing that can hurt him. He's humbled by her grace. Always has been. "Don't think I don't know how much I take you for granted," he says quietly, "or that I could ever forget what you've done for me and Ben, what you left behind." Taylor's smile shades into something fond and definitive. "I will tell you a secret, John. I did not do it for you. I did it because it was the right thing to do, and I could not have lived at peace with myself otherwise. So you see, I am also selfish." "I don't think..." He stops, but Taylor's inquiring look incites him to continue. "I don't think we're meant to cut ourselves off from home like this. I've always..." He shakes his head. He spoke the thought half-formed, and now it's gone. He's no longer sure what he meant to say. Cutting himself off from Earth or from Atlantis? "Perhaps we are not meant to leave," Taylor agrees carefully. "But when we have gone, neither can we return." That gives him a hard jolt, right under his ribs. "You wouldn't... If Ben and I weren't in the picture, you wouldn't jump at the chance to go back?" Taylor's hand on his face is cool and transient as rain. "I never had an opportunity for... space." She stops, as if unsure of the word, like it's foreign somehow, but she counts on John to translate and make up for the lack. "There was never time to think back on the decisions that were made. All energies went into survival and keeping ahead of the Wraith. When we met,
I had to choose quickly what would be best for my people. I have struggled to understand all that was at stake and not lose myself as well. She withdraws from their closeness, taking her eyes away to watch Ben's silent conversation with the seabirds. What we did to Michael. I do not believe that I appreciated what Dr. Beckett's treatment would do. I grasped it in my mind, but your science is still not something I was raised to understand. She huffs angrily. I do not seek to make excuses. I am trying to explain that since we left, I have looked on past actions with new eyes. In truth, since you disappeared with the Hive ship, I do not think I could take my new eyes to Atlantis and see what I see and be as I was. What do you mean? He had asked, before his world came crashing down. They are Wraith, she had answered pointedly, looking right at John like her team leader was a little slow. He chuckles now, a whisper of laugh aimed at himself. I think your old eyes work just fine.